G'day team, welcome to another installment of the U Project. Craig Anthony Harper reporting in for duty for episode number, I don't know, nearly 600, is it?
It's getting close. It's getting very close.
It's a lot of episodes. Pretty soon I reckon we're going to be good at it. Let's just keep trying. By number of thousand we might produce. Actually, today could be the day because we have a quality guest. But before we introduce our guest, how has your morning been?
It's been very good. I've been doing workouts in the studio, keeping people moving.
Oh, you and I haven't spoken since Mother Nature got fucked off yesterday at Melbourne and went, here, cop this. How did you go?
Oh, mate, I went all right. I was disappointed that I wasn't up at home upstairs, where when I got home, all my pictures had fallen over.
Now, so, we can tell.
You said too much info.
Yeah, but that's because you just met Anika and she's...
Now you want me to tell the world.
She's really sophisticated and proper, and then you're telling her that you're hovering over a portaloo. Go on, tell everyone what you were doing.
I was at the dog park, and it wasn't a portaloo. It was a real toilet block. And I said, Craig, you don't understand, because boys don't have to worry about it because they get to stand up, but girls don't like to, or I don't like to put my bottom on the seat. So I do a squat hold. I put my bring out my PT side and I do a squat hold over the toilet. And as I was doing that, the whole place shook and I thought there were kids just shaking the toilet block, which upon reflection was silly because it's a very sturdy toilet block.
Maybe if some superheroes flew into the park or something, but...
But I was in there going, kids these days, what are they up to now?
And when you came out from answering nature's call, were there just people running amok going, what's this about?
My friend was standing on the concrete near there and she said, did that just move from the wind or something? And we were talking about it and I said, I don't know, what do you reckon it was? And I said, I know exactly how to find out right now. And I went to the Elwood Facebook page, because everything in the world that happens goes down there, and someone else had put it down that it was an earthquake.
Well, I reckon we got, not that we want another earthquake, but I think as earthquakes go, considering it was nearly a 6, I think it was a 5.9, which apparently, I'm no seismologist, but apparently, in fact, I reckon our guest who knows everything about all things earth, mother nature, the environment will tell us. But as earthquakes go, significant ones, I think we got away relatively unscathed.
Yeah.
Anika Molesworth, welcome to the U Project. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Oh, you're very welcome. How much do you know about earthquakes? And I'm sure it's more than us two, even if it's next to nothing.
No, I know zilch.
Really?
Please no further questions on earthquakes.
That was disappointing. Right.
Thanks, everyone. That was Anika. Next up, we're chatting with... No. Well, have you ever been... Well, none of us have. Did you... There was nothing... Now, just tell us, you're in rural New South Wales. Just tell everyone where you are.
I'm in the far west of New South Wales on the beautiful red sand lands of Willikali country. And I live on my family's sheep station out here.
And I read that you grew up in Melbs, the thriving metropolis, the earthquake capital of Australia. You're welcome. And you bailed to somewhere prettier and nicer and more calming, I would suggest, when you were 12 years old, yeah?
That's it. Fewer earthquakes out here. So I thought, you know, that'd be safe. Get out of town.
There are less buildings that can fall on you, but more kangaroos that can jump on you.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I was 12 when my parents purchased our farm out here in the Wild West, and absolutely fell in love with this place. You know, endless horizons, big skies, kangaroos, emus in the paddock. And I'm one of the lucky people who gets to grow food for the world.
Yeah. What kind of, when you first went there as a 12-year-old, what kind of farm was it?
So when we actually first arrived here, it was very green and lush. And I remember just being amazed by the wildlife out here. And I used to get up at crack of dawn and go walking for hours in the paddock, not see another person, but I would see, you know, the most incredible bird life and little lizards, you know, scuttling amongst the bushes and the kangaroos. And I fell in love with the place.
How long did it take before? Because when you're 12, you're still young, right? You're real young. How long did it take before you were like a country girl? Like, you felt more like a country girl than a city girl?
Yeah, I think because I've always had a great curiosity with the natural world, like I always prefer to be outdoors than indoors. So I fell very quickly for this place.
Describe it to us. So us city slickers who are living in the concrete jungle, I literally live on a main road. You're going to be disgusted where I live. I live on a main road and with literally an acre within, within 500 metres of my house is probably 12 cafes, 500 either way. So a kilometre, and the street I live on, which is Hampton Street, is probably 40 cafes and 20 restaurants. So describe your environment. You walk outside in the morning, what do you see?
I see red sand vistas that stretch on forever. I go for walks past the dam and the windmill with my Kelpie dogs, see corellas flying overhead, ducks landing on the water, and breathe in this beautiful, crisp, dry air. And I really feel a sense of connection and belonging here. And that's what really has spurred and does spur my energy in the work that I do in regards to the environment and climate change, because this landscape that I am so privileged to call home is just so incredible and yet so fragile and deserves our care and respect.
Yeah. Now, I'm just going to read, by the way, you've got the longest bio in the history of bios and my shoes are older than you, so well done. I'm just going to read a bit because I want to ask you about some of it. Anika is an agroecology scientist. Did I say that right? Agroecology?
Yeah.
Yeah. Scientist and a farmer. She is passionate about food security, nature conservation, climate change, and rural community development. She currently sits on the board of directors of Farmers for Climate Action, the New South Wales Committee. You can update me if any of these are a little out of date. Of the Crawford Fund and is a governor of the WWF Australia, which in the old days used to be the World Wrestling West Wrestling Federation. I'm pretty sure that's not what we're talking about. She also, smarty pants, has a Bachelor of Science specializing in agribusiness. TIFF, pay attention, a Master's of Sustainable Agriculture and a PhD, the good doctor, in agro-co-systems. Where on earth do I start? So I'm going to go backwards. What did you do? I know you've got a PhD in agroecosystems. Firstly, what does that mean?
So I think it should be agroecological systems, potentially.
Agroecosystems. My bad.
Okay. It's agriculture and the environment, and it's the system. So it's how people, environment, climate, soils, livestock, food production all weave together. So it's the beautiful complexity of this system and how do we manage it as that beautiful complexity, not look at it in isolation and fragments and here's a problem over there that will solve by itself, but how does everything relate to each other and have that sort of bigger picture of how we overcome the challenges that face food producers, not only here in Australia, but around the world.
And what was your PhD research focus?
So I was looking at how to potentially replace synthetic fertilizers with organic fertilizers, doing studies in New South Wales and also in Cambodia. So I've always been very interested with the comparison of the developed agricultural world and the developing agricultural world, and not just, you know, what one can teach the other, but how we can share ideas from farmers around the world to improve our systems and way of doing things.
And we had correct me if I get anything wrong, I'm definitely out of my depth here having this conversation, but that's why we've got you, because you know. So we had a drought for a decade or so, and that definitely didn't help. This is a very broad question, but humor me. How are we now? Like, how are the farmers now? What's working? What's not working? What are the key challenges? And I'm sure this is a 1-hour answer, but do your best.
Yeah, that's a big question. What I love about Australian agriculture is pretty much we grow every food and fiber under the sun here. It's an incredibly diverse industry from, you know, the tropical fruit growers up in Queensland and the Northern Territory, you know, the bananas, the mangoes, the macadamias. And then as you move further south, you get, you know, you go into the wine country where it gets cooler. You grow crops like wheat and barley, rice and cotton. in the arid areas like where I am, you know, you have the sheep, the cattle, the goats, and, you know, something that I am really passionate about too is also promoting the native foods, you know, the indigenous crops of, you know, of kwandongs, of kangaroo grass, and how we can be better utilizing and celebrating native Australian foods in, you know, a contemporary Australian agricultural system. So the Australian agricultural sector is very diverse, and that's what it makes it very exciting to be a part of. And when you say, you know, what challenges we face, one of the common threads is a changing climate, in that it's getting hotter. We're seeing changes in rainfall patterns. A lot of the country, like where I'm from, it's getting drier. We're seeing changes in diseases and pests that eat our crops and challenge the welfare of our livestock. And farmers are wanting to do something about this. I mean, they love their homes, they love their environments. And there is a whole suite of things that farmers are doing to actually tackle these big problems that we face.
Like, it feels to me like, and I'm definitely an outsider living in a concrete bloody jungle, but it feels like there's more technology and science coming into the way that we farm and produce. Is that right? And if so, what are some of the things that are relatively newcomers to the space of farming and the production of, you know, all the stuff that we have in Australia?
Yeah, well, I really encourage you to, come and check out some of the amazing tech that is being used in the agricultural sector, because it really is mind-blowing. I mean, you can step into a tractor cab these days and there's 5 monitor screens and a DVD player where the farmer can kick back and the tractor drives itself, you know, up and down the field. You've got the researchers flying drones over the crops, monitoring the health of the crops, the nitrogen content, you know, this data is being picked up by these flying devices. You've got incredibly skilled people in the farming sector on the ground, you know, monitoring soil moisture, having automated systems that turn on and off to water crops, so we water them in the most effective way. You have this smart machinery that plants, you know, exactly where every single seed should be planted, and applying the fertilizer exactly where those seeds have been laid down. And that's why I find it incredibly, you know, exciting. And farmers really are a creative bunch of people who work out how to overcome challenges.
Well, I feel like, you know, in every industry, in every profession, you know, the people who work in those spaces on a lot of levels spend a lot of their life solving problems. And I feel like farmers have been solving problems for millennia, right?
Yeah.
And as PhD students do too. What about the oldest, like in every profession, again, in every industry, there are old school people who don't always embrace what you young people are doing. And what is it? What is she talking about, June? Is there resistance to technology in some sectors?
Like,
and we're not trying to throw anyone under the bus. I'm just talking about the culture of farming.
No, my neighbour John. No, kidding.
Bloody John. John, if you're listening, come on, son, get a drone.
That's it. Look, I think because farmers, like, they're savvy business people, they're working out like how to reduce production costs, how to be most efficient with their resources, because we have limited water resources out here. We have limited labor resources out in these rural areas. And so they're always trying to figure out, well, how to, you know, stay on top of things and to use their finances, their resources, their farmland in the most productive and profitable manner. So of course, I mean, the average age of an Aussie farmer is around 58, 59 years old. So there will be some, you know, conservative views and resistance, or, you know, even bordering on, you know, fear or concern of new technology, because it's taken a while to, it takes a while to learn these things. And that's why I think it's also great to encourage young people to look at the agricultural sector as, you know, a viable and interesting career option, because we want creative thinking, people who challenge the status quo, people who have been brought up with smartphones and computers at the tip of their fingers, who communicate daily with their peers around the world. That's how we get this, you know, the new thinking and innovation within the agricultural sector.
It is bloody amazing, isn't it, where you can I mean, you are, I don't know, 1,000, 1,500 kilometers away from us. We can see you in real time. It's clear. The audio is good. You know, the picture's brilliant. And I mean, we're just doing this. Well, we started doing this, I mean, because of COVID. And now when we come out of lockdown in 2046, I don't think we're going to go back to, like, I'll do a few episodes in the studio, but it's much more labor in, or it's much more complicated because I've got it. I would have to get you from where you are to Melbourne to get you. Well, and that ain't happening, right? So, and I was thinking, like farmers have got to be, you know, they've got to be all over, obviously, agriculture and science and business and marketing and problem solving and communication and, you know, relationships. And it's not like they've just got to be good at one thing. They've got to be good at many things to make the totality of the business and the industry work,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the tractor breaks down in the paddock, you're the mechanic. You know, a sheep is in the paddock struggling in labor, you're the veterinarian. You know, you've got to figure out the finances, how to run the business. You're constantly dealing with all these challenges, and every single day, I mean, there's something else thrown at you on the farm that you were not expecting and you didn't really need on your plate. But that's actually why I love farmers and the farming community so much. It's because they generally don't like sit around and point fingers and wait for someone else to fix a problem. They go and grab the pair of pliers and wire and they walk out in the paddock and they fix it. They do their best.
Yeah.
And I love that, you know, that mentality and that spirit of, okay, there's a challenge staring at me in my face and it's my responsibility to go out.
I grew up in the country. I did the reverse of what you did, right? I moved to the city when I was 18. So I still have a bit of country boy in me, and lots of people in my, or not lots, but quite a few people in my family were farmers. And yeah, there ain't a whole lot of time for self-pity when you're a farmer. It's not like we don't, yeah. It's like there's, you got too much shit to get done to sit in the corner and throw a pity party because you got cows to milk, or you got, like you said, fences to fix, or you've got problems to solve, or you've got, you know, hay to bale or whatever you've got, you know, depending on the kind of farm. But yeah, it doesn't really lend itself to, like, if you're lazy, don't be a farmer. If you're precious, don't be a farmer. Like there are a lot of, I think we talk about on this show, like yesterday, we had a guy on who was great, and we were talking about he's a veteran. He served in the army for a decade, and his job was dismantling bombs and detecting bombs with his dog, who was called Gus, and landmines and all that stuff. And we were talking about resilience, and I don't think there are many more resilient people. They're probably as resilient, but in terms of as a group of people, I think farmers, especially in Australia, especially in certain parts of Australia, would have to be right up there with the most resilient.
They're amazing breed of people, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. What was the learning curve for you when you got to the bush at 12 and thinking, I want this, not only do I love living here, I want this to become my career. I want to, this is what I want to do. I don't just like being in this joint. This is going to be my purpose. When did that happen?
I think it probably sparked as an idea quite early on in my life, actually. Like, I loved being outdoors. I love working, you know, alongside animals and nature. I love, you know, having a community around me, like a really close-knit community. And so I think I was naturally attracted to agriculture. And then my interest in sort of more the environmental management and climate change advocacy came a bit later, when I sort of really started to realize some of the big challenges and threats that are facing the farming sector.
What are some of the most, and I'm not opening a door because I want to debate, I'm just interested in the, like, there are lots of things that polarize people, especially right now. Everyone, it's like, oh, it drives me nuts. But anyway, everyone seems to live in their own little, excuse my language, Anika, fucking echo chamber of whatever. We're right. You're an idiot. If you don't think like me, you're a moron. If you don't think like me or have my ideology or philosophy, we can't be friends. And not only that, I hate you. I really don't understand that. But what are some of the tough messages that you need to share because you're a kind of a science communicator and agriculture environmental communicator. You get on stage, you do lots of media and social media. What are some of the toughest conversations for you to have and some of the topics to kind of open the door on for you as someone who is, and I know you're not a representative, but in a way you kind of are representing the industry.
Some of the tough conversations that, you know, need to be brought up and I do bring up is that, you know, the farming sector is part of the problem when it comes to climate change. You know, we're very much responsible for a lot of the emissions up there. But it's also that we as individuals, as a society, and especially as Australians, are huge drivers of climate change, which are challenging people, some very vulnerable people around the world. And I see and work alongside those people in the developing countries who really are struggling to feed their families today because of the droughts, the floods, and pest outbreaks that they are experiencing. And climate change exacerbates the challenges that vulnerable people face. And vulnerable people generally are rural-based, dealing with poverty, women, you know, young people, elderly, those kind of groups. So I think we need to really like listen and learn from science and not shy away from what it says. And sometimes, you know, when you look at a report about climate change or the latest science, you can feel overwhelmed and daunted and you just want to block your ears and tune off from it. And actually, we don't have the time to do that. Like, we actually have to front up and go, I am a problem maker, but that also means that I am the problem solver. And so we have to take on that, you know, problem solving mentality of this is a challenge that is staring me in the face and I'm going to get up and go outside and do something about it.
Why do you think that some people, I think it's a minority these days, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, but I'm sure you have an opinion. Why do you think that some people are resistant to the idea of global warming? Like, nah, it's not really a thing. Like, it just does this every couple of hundred years. This is just, if you look at the last 300 years, this just fits with the pattern, or I don't know what they say, but, and also I'm no guru at anything, let's be honest, but definitely not in this space. But yeah, why is there such controversy about this?
It sort of links back to what you very briefly touched on earlier about COVID, you know, the death of expertise in that people think that they are the expert. And because I've done some research on social media that I know just as much as the scientists who have dedicated their entire careers, spend every waking moment studying these things inside and outside. And I think there has been a loss of respect for the expert in whatever field that expert is in. And as scientists, you know, particularly those working on, you know, climate change and the natural world, we have to do a really good job of communicating, like, these are the facts. This is what's happening. This is what's driving the problem. These are potentially the solutions that are out there. And we have to be, you know, really, really great communicators of that. And, you know, at the moment, a lot of scientists actually don't have those skills. We haven't been trained to be communicators to the general public. We've developed skills to write academic papers and present, you know, tables and charts, but they're not very engaging. And obviously we need, you know, the media telling really good, true, honest accounts of what the science is saying. And we also need, you know, people in positions of leadership, business leadership, political representatives, also communicating that science in a really honest, truthful manner as well to engage the wider public and then give them actually the strategies and steps to get out of this mess that we're in.
Yeah, it is interesting. I'm doing my PhD at the moment and it's interesting that not in agroecology, of course, or what's your PhD in again?
Yeah, it's agroecology, agriculture and environment.
Definitely not in that. But it, you really hit it on the head. Like, and I'm part of like I'm at Monash in Melbourne, and I'm a part of a thing called Brain Park, which is the neuroscience department, and they're all brilliant, and I work with lots of other cool people. But, you know, as a PhD student, you spend your life reading academic papers in between punching yourself in the head, right? It is interesting that the academia is so hard to plow through, and the research and the data and the evidence, and it's like trying to eat five saladas fast, right? Or like, it's like shit. But then then at the other end of the scale, you have some people who are great communicators and fluid and dynamic and charismatic, who could talk underwater, but actually don't have any real science to back it up. Like, often when people say I've done my research, what they mean is I watched three videos on YouTube. That's not research, bro, at all. Or I read something that a bloke wrote that knows someone, or that a girl wrote that, or a lady wrote, or, you know, like research. People don't actually understand what quality research, and I'm not saying I'm the best researcher in the world, folks. I'm terrible at it, right? But I've got my L plates on training wheels, so I'm not putting myself up there. But actual deep research into something, like I'm literally spending 4 years researching one small component of psychology, like one like grain of sand in a desert of psychology. That's in human behavior. That's what I'm researching for 4 years, right? So when someone goes, yeah, I've done my research, I go, you really haven't, you know, and that's what you are contending with.
Yeah, exactly. And so we have to work out, you know, why people disagree very strongly against certain things that the experts, you know, the scientific community agree upon. Mm. And, you know, a lot of the time it's being driven by really bad narratives, by fear mongering, by, you know, dismissing or downplaying the evidence. And that's actually really dangerous. So I think we as a society have to do a much better job of, you know, respecting expert opinion, making sure that we're communicating it really well. And giving people the tools to actually understand that.
And also be, you know, I say on this show all the time, you know, one, we're not giving out advice or instruction or prescription, right? We're just having conversations. And I say to people, even with when we're doing something which is more down the human behavior, psychological rabbit hole, I go, don't believe what I say, just think about it and consider it. And I'm, by the way, I'm not an expert. And if I say something that resonates, still don't believe it, just maybe take it for a test drive and see if it works for you. I think we need to be really careful who we put up on pedestals as the high watermarks for intelligence or altruism or reliability, which is not to say there are not many great people. There definitely are. But some of the most smooth-talking, articulate, you know, kind of purveyors of information aren't always the most credible or reliable sources to pay attention to. So I think we've got to be wise about who we pay attention to and how much we do with that. Tell me about getting up on stage. So I know that I've seen you do a couple of things. You did a TED talk in Sydney, which looked like it was fun. Do you enjoy getting up in front of a real live audience with humans in a room with arms and legs in a three-dimensional plane?
No.
Are you an introvert?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, most farmers are, right? I mean, there's a reason we hang out in the bush.
Yeah. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I love hanging out in a sheep yard with a flock of sheep and my Kelpie dogs. And I do find it really difficult, actually, walking onto a stage to an audience of, you know, a few hundred, you know, 2,000 people in the town hall. Yeah, I've found it challenging, and it's something that definitely does not come naturally to me at all. And I've really had to overcome some, yeah, personal and mental barriers to actually be able to do that. Mm. But I do that because I have such conviction for the cause and such concern for what's actually happening in the rural communities, in the food system, to do with climate change. And I so strongly believe that something better is possible, but we're lacking the will and the determination at the moment to actually achieve that. that I'm willing to put myself forward and throw myself onto the stage and onto the social media and onto podcasts and talk about it until the cows come home so we can actually get to that better place. And then once we get there, I'm off. I'm out in the outback and you won't hear from me again.
That's hilarious. Until the cows come home, no pun intended. Well, you're good at it. You're good at it. But I can tell that it's not your natural habitat, not because you're not good at it, but because, you're very, what's the word? You're kind of self-deprecating, but I would have picked that you're doing it because it's your passion and you feel like you can, or you know that you can make a difference. But you're doing a very good job. Anyway, tell us about your Kelpies, because about 80% of our followers and listeners absolutely are dog nuts. I am one. Tiff is one. Is Coach there? Bring Coach over and show Coach to Anika.
She's out cold. Coach, come in. There's no getting her off that bed.
All right. Tell us about your Kelpies.
Yeah, they're little cutie pies. So much energy. And then I've also got a German wirehair pointer who is a terrible farm dog. You know, if you're looking for a farm dog, don't get a German wirehair pointer. Mm. Like a magnet to burrs and prickles, has a nose on him that you cannot control. Mm. But he is such a snuggler and a cutie.
So he's a complete fraud. He's a farm fraud.
Yeah, yeah.
And
he loves it out here, though.
Are they are the Kelpies working dogs or are they just pets?
So traditionally they are working dogs, but because we're in the fifth year of drought out here, we've actually sold our livestock. So we've destocked the property to make sure that we don't, you know, damage the environment and lose the vegetation cover. So the Kelpies spend a lot of time lying on the veranda and chilling out.
Just getting fat.
Yes.
Oh, come on, bro. Can't you just get one sheep for them to chase? They're probably like, come on, mum, give us something to do.
They kind of hassle the duck every now and again, you know, round her up.
How big's the property?
10,000 acres.
Oh, wow. Wow. So this is a naive question, but what kind of things keep you busy on a 10,000 acre property with no animals? Just maintenance and keeping things working, or?
Yeah, so a lot of maintenance, you know, doing the boundary run, making sure the fences are all intact, going out there inspecting the wildlife and the condition of the property. We love being involved in sort of citizen science projects. Yeah. So we've got like this cool app on the phone, a frog ID app by the Australian Museum. And at night we walk down to the dam and we record the frog calls, and that information gets uploaded to the Australian Museum, who then identifies frog species where they are around Australia. And so there's lots of different projects that we're involved with like that to actually help build the understanding of what species are where, you know, how is their abundance going? Are they disappearing?
Or how do you feel when you head back to the city? I know when I grew up in the country, I hated Melbourne. I hated it. I thought it stunk. I thought it was manic. I hated Melbourne when I was, because I'd never lived in a town bigger than 15,000 people, right?
Mm.
And so but how do you feel now that you're a straight up country girl when you go back to the urban jungle?
Like, I love going back for brief periods, and I've got family in Melbourne, so I love, you know, heading back to the city, catching up with family and friends, going for a walk along, you know, Brighton Beach and you know, seeing the surf there, but then I do love when I'm driving out back to Broken Hill and the horizon's just, you know, they're as far as the eye can see, and you smell that sort of red dust in the air. And yeah, I sort of feel that relaxing force of I'm going back home.
So
I love it.
So once things are, I think you said something like once things are kind of where, hopefully in a much better place than they are now, you're going to hang up your media hat. I don't blame you. Tell me the things that you want to happen between now and then. Like, and I'm sure it's a long list, but give us a snapshot of the things that you would like to see unfold in the next decade or so in that space in Australia and beyond.
Yeah, well, if I can sort of sorry. If I can tell you my big ambitions.
Sure.
Yeah. I want us to return the globe to a stable climate state, you know, what it should actually be. Mm. And that's going to take a lot of hard work and it's going to take a really long time.
Mm.
But I think that's where our ambition should be.
Mm.
I would love to help restore the health and vibrancy of the plants and animal communities, the native plants and animals. You know, we're losing biodiversity and species at a rate of knots, and that's really terrifying as well as saddening, you know, creatures that are never going to return. And we've got to turn that around and we've got to build back those numbers. I would love to help build the capacity of people in rural communities, because they're such a brilliant group of people, you know, out here in rural Australia, in the farming sector. And we need to make sure that they are resilient, especially in the challenging times, because the droughts are getting worse, the bushfires are getting worse, and we need people to have, you know, good mental health, know how to deal with these challenging times, and know how to thrive, you know, in this future going forward. And we often talk about, you know, transitioning to a low carbon economy and transitioning to this better world. What does that actually mean for rural people? How do we do that? How do we play a leading role in that? Because the farmers I know, the rural people that I hang out with, they want to be part of this, but they need to be given the skills, the knowledge, the steps, so they can play a leading role in looking after their homes and their environment and their communities.
Do you think, I don't know if this is right or wrong, I feel like a little bit, and it's not that we're bad humans, us city slickers, I'm only half a city slicker, but it's a little bit out of sight, out of mind, I think, Anika. I think it's like, because a lot of us are not directly impacted, you know, like day to day, we go, oh, yeah, global warming. Oh, yeah, the environment. Yeah. And then we go about our, you know, and I'm not trying to be judgy, but, you know, I feel like even for me, I feel like I've become somewhat disconnected from the earth, you know, and I feel... And this is getting deep, but this is honestly how I feel. I feel human beings as a species, since we've become so urbanized and we literally do live in concrete, man-made concrete jungles. Not saying that's bad, everyone, and jump up and down. But I feel one of the negative consequences of that is that we have become disconnected from our bare feet on soil. You know, that connection with literally that connection, that energy exchange between us and the earth, us and plants, us and animals, us and nature. And I feel that, like, for me, when I live 800 meters from the beach and from the water, in fact, very close to Brighton Beach, where you were talking about, and I walk every day, and every day I walk in bare feet because I like to feel sand and dirt and grass on my feet, right? Do you feel that we've become, you know, as in 2021, not through any intention, but just as a byproduct of how we live now, that there's become a disconnection between the nature that is us and the nature that is the earth?
Yeah. There's a lot to unpack there. But yes, because, I mean, like 95% plus live in urban environments, I mean, they're not seeing the river systems or, you know, those forests or things like that, where rural people, they live and work alongside these, you know, landscapes every day, day in, day out. And so a lot of rural people feel, you know, a very strong sense of connection to their environment. And this is particularly true in Indigenous communities, where they really feel a sense of belonging, you know, connection to place. And I would love to see more of that for more of us to feel that connection to place, a sense of belonging to our home. And I think that engenders, you know, a sense of responsibility to look after it. You know, when you love something, a place so much, and then you see it degrading or you feel fear for its future, you know, that care and compassion actually translate into action. You know, what can I do to actually look after this place? And I suspect, and, you know, say if I'm wrong here, but a lot of people in the lockdown times are sort of realizing that they actually really do miss being outdoors, and they miss that walk along the beach and spending time in the park. And maybe it is becoming, you know, more obvious that, like, I don't feel myself when I am actually disconnected from the outdoors and nature. And that's actually where I, you know, breathe in deeply and I feel myself and I feel relaxed. And so I hope people, yeah, get the opportunity to spend more and more time with the natural world, so then they can actually feel a sense of connection to it and then a sense of desire to look after it.
Yeah, you're actually spot on. You know, with COVID, this is just my experience and observation, but like I was up, my body and my mind are weird, right? Some nights I sleep forever, some nights I sleep for about 17 minutes and then I'm up. But anyway, I studied last night till midnight and then I woke up at 4:30 like my body had had 12 hours sleep. I don't get it. But anyway, so I got up, I don't know, about 5 to 5, put on my party dress and snuck out at 5:01 as per the COVID lockdown rules. And I went for a walk and obviously there was no one out. But by the time I got back, which was nearly 7, there's just people everywhere. And it's funny because when we're not in lockdown, there's half the people, not even that, a third of the people walking, maybe a quarter. And all of a sudden, you're right, Anika, everyone is so grateful to be able to move around and get outdoors. And down at the beach, it's like bloody Victoria Market. There are people everywhere. I mean, it's so busy. But, you know, I think that I think we don't realize, because you know, life is busy and we live in a version of Groundhog Day and you go to work and do work and you come home. Not right now, of course, it's a bit different, but in general terms and the kids and your partner and, you know, life, the busyness of life, and it's not good or bad. It's just the human experience. And then you're 40 or 30 or 50 or whatever it is, you know, and life just happens. But it's funny when you go back or for whatever reason, when you just find yourself again in nature, you go, oh, why don't I do this more? Like there is something deeper than just toes in dirt that's going on. You know, I think it's, I call it spiritual, which, you know, there's different things and, you know, there's something definitely emotional and psychological happening, but there's something otherworldly that goes on for me when I'm in that place. Right. And so it's bigger than me and I don't really understand it, but I also know that I don't need to understand it to benefit from it, just like I don't understand how this phone works that I'm holding up. I have no idea how that works, but I know that I can use it as a tool to create a positive outcome. You know, so I definitely think that just even being in nature, apart from all of the other things we've spoken about, it's healing, it's therapeutic. Yeah. You know, absolutely. It's literally therapy for people, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think then, you know, on the... It sort of goes to show that, you know, that the health of, you know, community and people is very much dependent on the natural world. And then when we sort of drill into that of, okay, well, when people actually see a suffering natural world, you know, when trees are cut down, when species are lost, when the bushfires, you know, turn landscapes to charcoal, people feel a real sense of grief and loss and like damage has been done and it causes, you know, stress and anxiety and depression in people. And so having a healthy natural world is absolutely essential for us as people to live healthy and stable lives.
Yeah. It's so interesting, you know, like, oh, we're finding a connection between your world and mine, but there's lots of research. You would love this. Well, there's not lots, but there's enough research that tells us that your environment, so situation, circumstance, environment, and let's talk about your physical environment, of course, has an impact on everything from your heart rate to your blood pressure to the hormones that your endocrine system is producing, nervous system, you know, like sympathetic or parasympathetic activity. And I know for me, I have genetically high blood pressure. Thanks, Mum. Thanks, Dad. So it's the only medication. Did you know that, Tiff?
I think you mentioned it on one other podcast.
Yeah. So I don't smoke, I don't drink, I don't eat junk food. I'm relatively healthy, touch wood. But I can because I'm so in tune with my body, I know when my blood pressure goes up or down. And I know when I'm in nature, I can physically discern it going down. And I can also feel my heart rate and my respiration going down, you know. And it's not a psychological trick. It's just a byproduct of where I am. And so, and then if we want to extrapolate that out further, we know that all of those things, if we do that on a regular basis, then we basically start to create real shift with our immune system, you know, which dictates a whole bunch of, you know, when we get sick, how long we're sick for, how quickly we recover if we get sick at all. You know, so definitely I feel like I should be the marketing person for nature right now. But anyway, what was I going to ask you? All right. So tell us about your book. You wrote a book, your first book published through Pan Macmillan. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Congratulations. Firstly, I've written a few books. Tell me that it wasn't fun, quick, easy, or painless. Tell me it was a nightmare and that it was hard.
I loved it. I loved every moment of
writing. It's because you're an introvert.
Exactly.
And you love sitting by yourself thinking in front of your computer.
So writing my PhD thesis was a nightmare for me. Like, I really struggled with it. And that's because, you know, writing a PhD thesis in science, you know, it's tables and graphs, and you pull out any emotion and any story. And I found it difficult to even read my own thesis. It was just... but on the other hand,
exactly how it's meant to be. You know, if it's not boring, dry, data-driven mumbo jumbo that's hard to fucking understand, well, you're not doing a PhD.
Oh, yeah, though it shouldn't be like that, but it is, unfortunately. And so when I started writing my book, I loved it because it was storytelling. It was describing the natural world and painting landscapes with words. You know, it was talking about the people and describing both their appearance, their hopes, their fears, and putting the humanity back into climate change. And so the book is sort of walking from the paddock to the plate of how climate change is impacting the food system and the farmers right along it. And although it sort of presents, you know, this is the science, this is the urgency and the seriousness of it, it's also a story of hope and vision and people who have, you know, this better image in their minds of what could be achieved and are working so hard to get there. And I really do believe that, you know, if we share better stories, if we change the narrative, if we can illustrate something better and inspire people to work towards it, then we will create a better future.
Well, I think you guys need a PR machine. Maybe you are the PR machine. You're the head of the... Now, the book is called Our Sunburnt Country. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
I can't believe that wasn't already taken. I read that when I was doing a little bit of research. And the book looks great, by the way. Book looks great. Title's great. I went, because I'm fascinated with selling stuff and titles and brands and taglines. And, you know, I went, oh, I can't believe that wasn't already gone. Good for you. What a good title. Now, where can people get that?
So the Pan Macmillan site has the links to different retailers, the audiobook, the ebook. Yeah, or if you Google my name, Anika Molesworth, you know, you'll track down the book fairly quickly. I'm spruiking it on all my channels.
You should be. It's a great effort. How long did it take you to write?
About a year and a half.
Yeah, great.
So I did it pretty intensely, definitely for like the first 6 months. You know, I was interviewing a lot of people. I was sitting by myself with the phone off, just writing and enjoying it.
Isn't it great when you write your own stuff where you don't have to, I mean, of course you reference who you're talking to, but you don't have to reference, you don't have 27 people that are going to analyze it and you know, based on academic validity or credibility or whatever, but you can just write from the heart and from, you know, from your soul, where you're just expressing your thoughts and ideas and stories and perspective, and you can't be wrong because you're just sharing your philosophy, your ideology, your story. It's like, it's yours. It can't be wrong because it's yours.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a story that, you know, I'm so proud to actually put out there in the world. It's a story that I want to read personally, and I want others to read. And I also felt so privileged when I started doing the interviews, because I spoke to farmers right around the world, you know, Argentina, Nigeria, Kenya, about the challenges, the very real challenges that they face as food producers, but then what they are doing. And I felt, you know, this great privilege and honor to be a sharer of their stories, passing that into the world.
Are we becoming more of a global community in this space, or is there still a lot of separation?
I think the farming community, which, you know, obviously I'm involved with, is incredibly connected. And, you know, I do think of farmers around the world as my extended farming family. And we're trying to, like, you know, work on these problems together. You know, how do we deal with less rainfall? How do we deal with these strange new insects or diseases that are challenging our food production ways? How do we actually feed a rapidly growing global population? And they are big conversations, and they are big challenges, none more bigger, if to be honest. And you've got this, you know, amazing group of, like, honest, hardworking people who are looking at this every single day, and you know, they're trying to use these, you know, online technologies, you know, to actually work together and to share information. And that's what I really do love about the farming community too. It doesn't seem like information stops at borders or within, you know, industries. We're very willing to help each other.
I've got good and bad news for you. The good news is you're really good at this. You're really good at it. You're very inspiring and you know your stuff. The bad news is I don't think your job is going to be done anytime soon. So I don't think you're going to be hanging up the microphone in the next 20 or 30 years and just retiring to the farm.
I feel like we're at, you know, a social tipping point where more and more people are aware and concerned about the big global sustainability challenges that we face, and climate change in particular. And I think when we get enough people, like, speaking about these issues, standing up, saying that I'm not going to be a silent witness to this anymore, like, I want change, I'm going to demand change, that's when things are going to start changing very quickly. And I feel like we're on, you know, the cusp of those social tipping points now.
So, Anika, for people who are listening going, all right, I'm in, I'm convinced, and I don't really know where to start, but I'd like to do something. I'd like to help a little bit, or educate myself a bit, or support, or what can we do? Where can we start?
So I'm part of an organization called Farmers for Climate Action. And it is an amazing group of over 6,000 farmers here in Australia and over 35,000 other members, non-farmer members. And we are, you know, all inclusive. You know, if you're concerned about food and farming and climate change, you know, sign up to the newsletter, jump on our webinars, you know, follow us on social media, because we're doing an amazing job, you know, communicating the science, working with the scientists. So we've got the best research being pushed out there about, you know, how these challenges are, you know, being dealt with in the farming community. And people are constantly, you know, brainstorming about how do we solve them together, because we don't solve them in silos, in separation, rural versus urban. We solve them by coming together and working out the problems.
Connection
together.
And collaboration. It's what it's all about. Yeah. So your website is Anika Molesworth. So I'm going to spell it, everyone. A-N-I-K-A, Anika, A-N-I-K-A, M-O-L-E-S-W-O-R-T-H, Anika Molesworth, oneword.com. With the W's at the front. And also she's on Insta, because of course she is. Hey, by the way, can you follow her? She doesn't have many followers. I was a bit disappointed. So lift your game. At Anika Molesworth on Insta. So give her a follow, give her a little bit of love and support. And if you enjoyed this, tell her she's ace. Have a look at her website. It's also great. Now, before you go, I'm guessing being the governor of the WWF Australia is not the World Wrestling Federation. What is it?
Yeah, I wish I was that cool.
Yeah, that would be, I mean, that would be awesome.
I know. The World Wildlife Fund.
Yeah. I knew that. That just, yeah. But because I grew up with the WWF, the other one, I was distracted. Sure. Hey, Nika, thank you so much. We really enjoyed you being on the U Project. Let us know if we can do anything to support and steer people in the right direction, and maybe we'll get or maybe you'd like to come back another time and have a chat with us about something that's close to your heart and that you're passionate about. But we really appreciate you today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much to both of you for the chat.
We do what we can. Stay right there. Don't go anywhere. We're going to say goodbye to the masses. Then we'll say goodbye to you off air. Tiff, well done.
Thank you. Thanks, Annika.
My pleasure. No, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for being had. All right, everyone. Love your guts. See you next. By the way, go and do something. Just do what Annika said. Go do something. Good on you. Love you. Bye.